This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Why are you a Beatles fan?
I was a huge Beatle fan. In fact, I was a Beatle freak from a very early age. And although today, after doing the research for 8 years, I retired the research, the ongoing research, back last November, but up to that point, it was 8 years. I could still appreciate the craftsmanship of the music, but the luster around the Beatles and the music is completely gone, because once you realize how it was done, then the Cinderella story disappears. The songs are good. I can appreciate the craftsmanship of the songs. Mm. And I'm a musician and a songwriter, and I credit the Beatles in large part to why I picked up the guitar, why I decided to write songs and record. But as good as the songs are, and it's not just the Beatles, we can go to the Rolling Stones, we can go to the Kinks, we can go to Led Zeppelin, we can go to the Who. As good as those songs are, those songs had an agenda behind it. And that's what we have to really get our arms around.
Have you got a favorite Beatles album, or did you?
My favorite album was Abbey Road.
Ah.
I loved Abbey Road. Until this day, I can still listen to Abbey Road, and it's a great recording. It flows nicely. So, yeah, I would say Abbey Road is at the top of my list.
Not Sgt. Pepper's.
Sgt. Pepper is probably third on my list. There is Abbey Road. I really enjoyed Revolver. Mm. I used to play Revolver all the time when I was a kid. That was a seventh studio album. And then Sgt. Pepper. Pepper, I enjoy most of the songs on the album. I think there are some throwaways. Good Morning, as an example. I don't find that song to be very appealing. And also, Pepper has kind of dated itself over the years, over the decades, because it was a psychedelic record for the psychedelic era. And I can listen to it today. I can appreciate it. But it doesn't hold up like Abbey Road, in my opinion, or Revolver.
I've always thought the cover of Sgt. Pepper was a bit dodgy.
Well, it's it's a funeral scene with lots of colors, and the Beatles dressed in various colorful outfits, which is a nod to the cult of Pan. Those are pied outfits. Pied means multicolored, so it's the cult of Pan, and they're all holding wind instruments, which is another nod to the cult of Pan.
But the actual album cover with all the different celebrity faces on it.
Yeah. Well, those were people that were told that the Beatles personally appreciated. There were some people that were left off. They left Jesus off originally. They were going to have Jesus on the cover. They were going to have Adolf Hitler on the cover. But they decided that Jesus and Hitler were going to not make the photo shoot.
But they added Aleister Crowley.
Yes. Well, that's because the Beatles, as an entity, are immersed in the occult, and in particular with the teachings of Aleister Crowley and his religion of Thelema. And it's no coincidence that they have him in the upper left-hand corner of the album cover, which would represent the left-handed path of Luciferianism.
Okay, so Mike, zoom out a little bit. Give me the bird's eye view of this conversation.
Well, most people, 99.9% of the world population, especially those that are into the Beatles, have one narrative that is the dominant narrative in the world. And it tells us that the Beatles were these four working class guys from Liverpool. They connected in with Brian Epstein, who owned NEMS record store. And under Brian's management, they were able to land a recording contract with, at the time, if I'm not mistaken, EMI was the largest record company in the world back in the early 1960s. And so They got signed in June of 1962, and from there, the band went on to unparalleled fame and success. So that's the story. And we're told that John Lennon and Paul McCartney are some of the most, if not the most, prolific and genius songwriters in pop music of all time. That the Beatles were great musicians, and that they were a perpetual motion machine of songwriting. So that's the narrative in a nutshell that most people grab onto and believe. And when I started my research back in 2016, I found a different narrative. And it's a narrative that's very, very different than the one I just explained.
So I'm guessing a starting point could be, were they this organic icon of counterculture?
No. If you're asking me, based upon my research, the answer is no. The Beatles were not organic, nor were the Rolling Stones. Really, none of the bands that were coming out of the British invasion. And in all actuality, none of the bands that followed the genres of music, all of the music is created and manufactured. And it's created and manufactured in order to social engineer and to steer beliefs and values and ethics in a particular direction. We can get into that in a little bit, maybe a little later. But the Beatles themselves, no, they were not organic. The Beatles, when they were in Hamburg, and we'll start there, when they arrived in Hamburg in August of 1960, they were mediocre musicians at best, and they showed no songwriting prowess at all. So when they got to Hamburg, that was what that really was boot camp for them. So they were being handled and groomed and brought along. And I would argue that their first handler was their first official manager, Alan Williams. And Alan is the manager that took him into Hamburg. And then later on, in the latter part of 1961, that's when they connected with Brian Epstein. So the Beatles were a bar and club band. That's what they were. And when they were in Hamburg, they were playing for hours, virtually every night for the number of weeks that they were there. So they might do 3, 4, 5, or 6 week stints at Hamburg. And then they would come home to Liverpool, and they were playing constantly these gigs throughout Liverpool locally and outside of Liverpool. And all of this... But
they weren't called the Beatles, though, at that time, right?
No. They were called the Quarrymen going back before the Hamburg days when they were playing at the Casbah Club, which was owned by Pete Best's mother, Mona, which was actually in their house. And Pete's mother, Mona, actually, she got pregnant by Neil Aspinall. And Neil was very close to the Beatles. He later on became the chief executive for Apple, years later. And Mona and Neil had a son whose name is Rogue. That's R-O-G-U-E. So, you know, that in itself, you might say, okay, so an older lady had an affair with a younger guy, and they had a child and so on. But when you look at it, it's all tied in. It's like it's all in the family. And so the Beatles played at the Casbah Club. They got their start there. In an interview that Pete Best did many years ago, he said that his part in the band, aside from drumming, was to get the Beatles gigs. That's Pete's story. And then, of course, when Alan Williams picked them up, that's when they headed into Hamburg. And that's when things really picked up for them. And Hamburg was boot camp. And when I say that, what I mean is the Beatles were not, as I mentioned, great musicians. They didn't show any aptitude for songwriting. So what was their purpose for going to Hamburg? Why would they go there? Well, they would go there because Tavistock was looking to groom them to get them to become better performers. And what do I mean by that? Well, since my research shows where I landed is that the Beatles did not write all of their own music and they did not play on all of their recorded tracks. Well, what was going on? Well, Tavistock needed them to be quick studies for when they were taught music, the music that was credited to them. They didn't write that. They were taught that music. And so when Tavistock was ready to throw the switch for Beatlemania, the Beatles had the skills to be able to learn the songs and then take them out on the road. And the big moment that really kicked everything off was when the Beatles landed in America on February 7th of 1964. And they came to America with the tagline, Jern, that said, "The Beatles conquer America." And conquering America was very, very important because America was a huge obstacle to the One World Order agenda in order to put in place a One World Order. So we had this country that was known for its freedom, its ability to stand on its own, have its independence, and that was a big problem for the New World Order. So the Beatles were put together to challenge traditional values, basically to take apart traditional values, and also to attack traditional institutionalized religions. And the one that was in the crosshairs, the most dominant religion, especially in the U.S., was Christianity. So that was the Beatles' main goal, was to social engineer, not just the United States, obviously, it also took place out in Britain and the U.K., across the world. But by the time they got to the U.S., they were a worldwide phenomenon. And so that's the mission that Tavistock put them on, and that's what they started doing. Whether the Beatles themselves actually knew the full extent of what the program was about, that's up for debate. And my personal opinion is they did not. They knew enough to get the job done, but in no way were these guys that were in their young 20s by the time they got to America in February of 1964, were they on board with a full-blown internationalist plan for total control of the world.
That was the only tour of America, wasn't it?
No, they did a tour in 1965 too, before they got to to the studio to record Rubber Soul. And they also did a U.S. tour in 1966, where they played Candlestick Park and Seattle and other locations.
But what was
other
that
venues?
I'm getting my wires crossed now. But what was that tour that they did where they couldn't hear themselves in the stadium?
Well, that could be any number of concerts that they did. They had said, I don't know which tour in particular it was, but that's a narrative where they would go on stage and because of the level of the screaming and the noise that they could not hear themselves play.
Mm.
So back in those days, especially, they didn't have playback speakers, fullback speakers to hear themselves. And they were singing through the PA systems at the ballparks in the United States. So as an example, when they played Shea Stadium in New York, they were singing through the PA system, which is absolutely unbelievable. The sound quality would be horrible. Mm. So they couldn't hear themselves, and they said it was becoming very frustrating. And that was actually kind of cascaded into why they stopped touring. They found that things were becoming too routine as far as their set lists when they were playing between 1962 and 66. And so they took a hiatus from playing live, and that's when they got into their studio years from late 1966 going into 67 and Sgt. Pepper through 1970 when the band disbanded.
I suppose another part of the story is they're unbelievably fast. They've unbelievably rapid rise to fame.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's something that should pique somebody's interest if they're taking a look at how the trajectory took place. If somebody's critically thinking, I should say, then there should be a lot of questions. So just quickly, I'll take you through it. So they arrive in Hamburg in August of 1960, and it doesn't go well for them. By December of 1960, they head home, and absolutely nothing transpired. In books that have been written about the Beatles and their time in Hamburg, one is Joseph Niesgoda's book, Lenin Prophecy. He explains that when the Beatles were there, being young guys, that they were drinking, popping pills, they were popping speed in order to be able to perform into the late evenings for 7 hours a night at the Hamburg clubs. They were having lots of fun with the ladies. So they were doing what young guys in a band would do in a place that was not close to home, right? They're from Liverpool, and there they are in Germany, and they've got, you know, it's the red light district. There's lots of bars and booze, and they're playing in a band. So, you know, they did the old rock and roll thing as young men. So then what happens is starting in early 1961, January of 1961, we've got this band that didn't do anything in Hamburg. They did not leave a mark. And now all of a sudden they're getting these gigs virtually every day locally near Liverpool and adjacent areas. So the first question we have to ask ourselves is, well, who's promoting this band? Who is getting these gigs for the band? If a band is not good, and even the Beatles themselves, if we listen to Billy, aka Paul McCartney, talk about the Beatles' early years, he explains that they were not a very good band, but yet they're getting booked to play these shows. And then in November of 1961, they connect with Brian Epstein, or Epstein, depending upon how people want to pronounce his last name. And Brian meets them at the Cavern Club and says he loves them and he wants to sign them and he wants to manage them. So that happens. Then in January of 1962, this band that just got its start really in Hamburg of August of 1960 fell on their face. 1961, they're doing all these gigs. They meet Brian Epstein in November of 61. In January of 1962, they're sitting in Decca's recording studios, Decca Records, and Decca is giving them an opportunity to record a demo. So it was 15 songs, 12 of which were covers, and 3 were nondescript original compositions that never made their way onto any of the Beatles' albums while the band was together. 2 of those songs ended up on the anthology collection in the 1990s, and one of the songs, I forgot the name of the song, I believe is still unreleased. So the first question we have to ask ourselves is, how did this band that really has no track record of success and not showing any aptitude as far as being great musicians or songwriters, how did they wind up in Decca? How did they get a demo? So to make a long story short, Decca turns them down and says, no, we're not going to sign you. A month later, Brian Epstein takes takes tapes to George Martin at EMI, Parlophone. Now, what we need to also understand is that George Martin is not just a producer. He is the head of the Parlophone label. So Parlophone is tucked in under the EMI corporate structure. So Brian plays these tapes for George Martin. George takes a listen to them, and he says, based upon what you're playing me, I'm not interested. I'm not going to sign them. So now they've got turned down by Decca, and now they've been turned down by EMI Parlophone, by George Martin. And a month later, in March, somehow the Beatles wind up getting a gig with the BBC. All right, so that's another question we have to ask ourselves. There's no track record here. Turned down by 2 record labels, and now you've got a gig with the BBC. And that gig with the BBC ran from March of 1962 through May of 1965, if memory serves me correctly. So it was a pretty long stint. And then in June of 1962, George Martin has a change of heart. And he signs the Beatles to a contract. Now the question becomes, why did George change his mind? And that's something that, again, is open to debate and speculation. You'll hear one story that says that he was having an affair with his boss's secretary, and as a way to get back at him, a form of, quote, lack of a better term, punishment, he was told to take on this band. I personally don't subscribe to that story. And the person that he was having the affair with became his wife, Judith. So they later on, George got divorced from his first wife and he married Judith. I don't grab onto that story. I think more likely what happened was George was not yet brought into the loop as to what the plan was for the Beatles. So when Brian Epstein shows up and plays in the tapes, George doesn't have the full picture at this point. And then what happens is he's brought into the loop. And he said, look, you got to take these guys on. And even though you made the right decision, because they weren't great musicians, they weren't great songwriters, there's other stuff that's going on, and we'll bring you on board, but right now, just get them signed. And so his boss at the time was a guy by the name of Len Wood, and Len and George Martin were knockheads every so often, and a lot of times it was over compensation because George didn't feel like he was being compensated properly or as much as he thought he was worth. But the CEO of EMI was Sir Joseph Lockwood. So I think what happened, and again, this is me speculating, is that he was not completely on board. He wasn't brought into the loop yet because this is how it works. Everything is compartmentalized until it's time to bring other people in. And it was either Len Wood or Sir Joseph Lockwood himself. If it came from Len Wood, it obviously would have come from Lockwood telling Len Wood to tell George that he's got to sign the guys, to sign them. And at that point, what happened was when George took them on, he didn't work with them right away, one-on-one. He assigned it to another producer that was on the EMI payroll. And Ron Richards, in fact. Ron Richards later became the producer for the Hollies, who were also signed to the Parlophone label. And so great, when Ron
great
worked
band.
With...
Great band.
What's that? Oh, the
Hollies?
Hollies
were a great band.
Mm. Yeah, the Hollies, great harmonies, great vocals. In fact, if you go back and listen to the Hollies music, it sounds very much like the Beatles music.
Yes.
Maybe we could talk about that a little bit. But so what happened was, so George is not working with him directly. He says, okay, I'll sign him. And then he says, Ron, work with these guys, see what they can do in the studio. And so Ron is working with them, spends a number of hours recording, and the recordings don't go anywhere. So in the book, The Memoirs of Billy Shears, which is the book that really kicked this all off for me, the book was published back in 2009, but I didn't pick it up until 2016. George Martin and I think Brian Epstein are listening to the playback, and it's obvious that this is not going to work. It was at that time that George receives another phone call, George Martin, and he's told, okay, look, there's no more delegating. You're going to work with this band directly, and you're going to be the point person. And I refer to George as the managing director of the Beatles operation. And George Martin was very, very important to how the Beatles came together. Now, interestingly enough, there was an interview that was done in 1976 with Phil Spector. Now, Phil Spector, by the age of 25, was a renowned producer, very sought after. And in that interview, it was out of an Australian music magazine called RAM, R-A-M, which is interesting because Paul McCartney or Billy's second album was titled RAM. And in that interview, Phil Spector explains that the Let It Be album was not the first time that he worked with the Beatles. And in that discussion with the person that's interviewing him, he explains that he had been working with the Beatles all along and that he had a very important role in the creation of the Beatles and what they accomplished. So the person who's interviewing him is dumbfounded because who's ever heard this story before? And then Phil says to him, think back, was I not on the plane with them when they arrived in the United States on February 7th of 1964? And Phil was. He was on that plane. So now the light bulb is going off in the interviewer's head, and he's starting to piece it together. So to make a long story short, we have that piece of the puzzle too. Now, why should we believe Phil? Well, first of all, like I said, he was a very important and dominant player in the music industry at the time. And Phil, his de facto band, was the LA-based Wrecking Crew.
And I think Phil also worked with the Ramones, didn't he?
Yes. Yes. Yep, the Ramones. And he worked with George Harrison and John Lennon, a lot with John Lennon during John's solo career. So with that article, with that interview, we have another player now that is, you know, that needs to be looked at, and that's Phil Spector. So Phil rattled off that he was there for, you know, Rubber Soul, Sgt. Pepper, and so on. And because his band was the Wrecking Crew, the Wrecking Crew was a network of studio musicians, LA-based, and they were on many of the pop records. The musicianship, the playing that you're hearing on your favorite pop artists back in the day was the Wrecking Crew and not the artists that you think were on the record. So as an example, the Byrds, the Wrecking Crew was behind the Byrds music. We have the Beach Boys and Pet Sounds. That's not the Beach Boys playing the music on Pet Sounds. That's the Wrecking Crew. Yeah. Yeah. It's not the Beach Boys. The Beach Boys sang, but the Beach Boys weren't the instrumentalists. They were not the musicians on the record. It was the Wrecking Crew.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, if you take a look at the Wrecking Crew, I invite the audience to look it up, and you can go to Wikipedia, and they will list a whole slew of bands and artists that the Wrecking Crew supported. So now, and the Wrecking Crew was Phil Spector's band. So that starts to ask, now we have to start asking the other question. Well, did the Wrecking Crew play on Beatle records? So there's an interview with Bernard Purdy going back to, I think it was 2004, he did an interview with Red Bull. Now, for those who don't know who Bernard is a studio drummer, one of the most recorded studio drummers in modern times. He's in the Drummer Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And back in 1978, Bernard said that he drummed on 21 early Beatle tracks. So when he talks about the early Beatle tracks, he's in all likelihood referring to the first three albums, which would be their debut UK album, and their UK releases are their official releases. It would be Please Please Me, the second album with the Beatles, and their third album would be A Hard Day's Night. And he said that he recorded the drums on 21 tracks, let's say, over those three albums. Now, did Bernard play on Beatle Records recordings after A Hard Day's Night? It's possible. So,
Hang on. Would Ringo today know about this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Ringo, in the 2004 interview with Bernard Purdy, the Red Bull interview, it's very, very enlightening. Bernard goes into great detail. In fact, what I'll do, Jeremy, is I'll send you a link to that interview and you can listen to it. And Bernard goes, he explains it, and he's talking about it. He said, look, it was just a job, okay? And he said, even though the public doesn't understand this, it's a well-known practice within the industry to have studio musicians playing on the recordings and or to have studio musicians fix recorded tracks. So Bernard said that he fixed those 21 tracks, which means he drummed on them. And in that interview, in the Red Bull interview, he says that, and he's talking about the early period. And when I say the early period, I'm talking about the 62 through 66 period. The later period would be 67 through 1970. That's the Billy period. 62 to 66 was the biological pull period. And Bernard said that.
Hang on. The biological pull period. We're just going to make a bookmark there.
Yeah, let's make a bookmark there. We'll get back to that because we kind of jumped ahead there. I jumped ahead. You know, I've been talking about this so much. Sometimes I get on a point. I just go. So in the interview that Bernard did in 2004, he said that there were four drummers on the Beatles recordings, and I interpreted what Bernard was referring to was the early period, 62 to 66, and he said there were four drummers, and Ringo was not one of them.
Sure.
So who were the drummers? So we know Alan White was hired by George Martin to play on at least two songs, Please Please Me and P.S. I Love You. P.S. I Love You and Love Me Do. Okay, those two songs. And those are the two songs that the official narrative is willing to admit to. I believe that Alan White played on – I keep saying Alan White. Andy White. Alan White – I'll get to Alan White in a moment. Alan White was the drummer for Yes. So Andy White drummed on those two songs, and the official narrative admits to it. Then Bernard came out in 1978 and said he drummed on 21 Beatle tracks. Now, some people want to say, no, he drummed on the pre-Beatle fame tracks that they recorded with Tony Sheridan. He did. He drummed on those as well. He fixed those tracks as well. So he drummed on the Tony Sheridan tracks, and he drummed on the 21 Beatle tracks. So we have Andy White, we have Bernard Purdy, and when I released my big presentation back in April of 2020, where I concluded that I presented my findings, and I concluded that the Beatles did not write all their own music and they did not play on all of their recorded tracks, I received an email from somebody who was a relative of the late, great session drummer out of the UK, Ronnie Verrill. And this person told me that Ronnie Verrill also drummed on Beatle tracks. So that's the third drummer. Now, the fourth drummer is up for discussion. Now, if we believe Phil Spector from that 76 interview that he has been involved with the Beatles from the very beginning, then that would say that perhaps one of the drummers from the Wrecking Crew drummed on Beatle recordings. And who could that be? Well, it could be Hal Blaine. Also, there was a clip from July of 1968 where Glenn Campbell, who was with the Wrecking Crew, Glenn has passed away, but he was a phenomenal guitar player. And he was co-hosting the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour back in July of 68. And he was introducing the band Cream, which would be Eric Clapton, Jack Bruce, and Ginger Baker. And Ginger Baker would be the drummer. And during that intro, Glenn explains that the guys from Cream, being top studio musicians out of the UK, played on Beatle recordings, the Rolling Stones, and he clicked off a number of other bands. So why is this important? Well, it's important because here we have a guy, and I don't think that Glenn realized what he said. He just kind of rolled with it. What he's saying is that Eric Clapton, Ginger Baker, and or Jack Bruce, all three, played on Beatle recordings. Now, people will say, no, he was pointing to Eric Clapton playing on While My Guitar Gently Weeps. The problem with that argument is that Glenn introduced the band and made his comment in July of 1968. According to the official narrative, George Harrison did not ask Eric Clapton to play on While My Guitar Gently Weeps until 2 months later, in September of 68. So I believe it's possible that Eric played on Beatle recordings as well as Jack Bruce, the bass player, and Ginger Baker.
Mike, would you – sorry for interrupting. Sorry, I might jump in really so often. I hope you don't mind. No. Who do you think created that guitar riff for While My Guitar Gently Weeps? It's very beautiful.
Well, the actual chord progression, the actual chords, or the lead guitar play?
I suppose both.
Yeah, well, it's the guitar chords. It's descending bass line. It is very good. Now, whether did George Harrison write that? I don't know. Is it possible? Yeah, it's possible that George wrote the chords and the lyrics to While My Guitar Gently Weeps. The lead guitar was not George. The lead guitar was Eric Clapton. And that's well known. And that's in the official narrative. Clapton came in and played lead guitar on the song. What I should say is before, because that's a good question you asked, what I found was that my personal opinion, based upon my findings, where I landed, my conclusion is that the Beatles did not write any of the music between 1962 and 1966, nor did they play on the recorded tracks in the early period. That's where I landed. Now, the later period, 67 through 1970, George and John wrote more of their own material and played on more of the recorded tracks, but the Beatles, as an entity, were still utilizing ghostwriters and studio musicians to fill out the songs on an album. So I would recommend, if this sounds, I know it sounds heretical to people, but if you listen and watch my presentation, Did the Beatles Write All Their Own Music, going back to April of 2020, and then I did a follow-up in April of 2023, 3 years later. It's called Did the Beatles Write All Their Own Music, The Addendum, where I introduce more evidence to support my position. And then about a year after that, early last year, I did a whole presentation on Rubber Soul itself. Because Rubber Soul, Jerem, is the silver bullet that, in my opinion, proves that the Beatles did not write all their own music and did not play on all of their recorded tracks.
Why? Can you summarize?
Yeah. The Beatles, we're told, the official narrative tells us that the Beatles came into the Rubber Soul sessions, which they arrived in the studio at EMI Studios on October 11th of 1965, with essentially no backlog of music. They had no songs written. Now, the official narrative will tell us that there were a couple of songs like Michelle and We Can Work It Out where there were partials. One of the songs, Wait, was pulled in from the help sessions, but overdub still needed to get done during the Rubber Soul sessions. So we had maybe, you know, three or four songs which were partials. That's what the official narrative tells us. I personally don't believe that they came in with anything. So the story goes that the Beatles were on the hook to record 16 songs from scratch, writing from scratch, between October 11th of 1965, and they needed to wrap up by November 11th of 1965. So over 30 days, 16 songs from scratch.
That's not possible.
No, I know. That's exactly the right answer. So they come in with nothing. Now, some people want to argue again, oh, they had partial of this, partial of that. I'm like, fine. Pick a number. 12 songs, 14 songs, 16 songs. Even if it was 12 songs, you're not going to write, learn, rehearse, arrange, and record 12 songs, 12 to 16 songs in 30 days. Because it defies the songwriting process. I'm a songwriter. I'm a longtime songwriter. I'm a musician. I know the process. Now, do some songs come easily and quickly? Sure. But most songs don't land in your lap. You've got to work them. So that was problem number one. There was 14 songs for the album and 2 songs for a double A-side single. We can work it out in Day Tripper. So 16 songs. In Mark Lewison's book, I forgot the title, which book it is. I have Mark's books. But he admits, and Mark is considered to be the Beatle historian. He admits in the book that the Beatles had to write from scratch. They had to come up with more than a dozen new songs for Rubber Soul. So here we have Mark Lewison, considered to be the Beatle historian, saying that they had to come in and write more than a dozen songs. So more than a dozen means you start with 13. And so pick a number between 13 and 16. Now, there's a Beatle magazine that was published back in October of 1965. I forgot the name of the magazine. I don't have it in front of me right now. But in that October 1965 edition of the Beatle magazine, there's a brief interview with Paul McCartney, and he's being asked about the upcoming album, Rubber Soul. And in that article, Paul is quoted as saying that the cupboard was bare, that they didn't have any songs. So all of the narratives within the official story are telling us that they essentially had no backlog of music, and they had to write from scratch all of those songs, not just for the album, but also for a single. And so I concluded that it was not possible. And the second issue with Rubber Soul has to do with the manufacturing cycle. And there just was not enough time to be able to press the record and to get it out into retail by December 3rd of 1965. So what the story tells us is the Beatles finished up recording on November 11th into the very late hours, actually the early morning hours of November 12th. George Martin finishes the mixing of the songs. I think it was on November 15th. And then he does the song sequencing, completes that on November 16th. Now, song sequencing is very important because that's the order in which the songs are going to play on the album. So you have side A, song 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Flip the album over. Side B, song 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And song sequencing is important for two reasons. One, it establishes the flow of the album, keeps the album of interest to the listener, but also there's a technical aspect as to why have to be very diligent with sequencing, and that has to do with ensuring that both sides of the album are balanced properly. In other words, there's enough dead wax at the end of the last track on each side of the record for the label. Now, why is that important? Because back in the day, with 33 RPM records, as your needle is moving closer and closer to the label toward the spindle, the tracks compress. And that compression can cause what's referred to as groove distortion. So the record companies back in the day did their very best to ensure that when the records were played, that you didn't have groove distortion, because what groove distortion does is it distorts the song. So your listening experience is going to be impacted, because the songs like track 5, 6, and 7 may not sound as good as tracks 1, 2, 3, and 4. And that's because of the tracks compressing and then groove distortion. So it's very important. But more importantly is this. When records are pressed, the labels are pressed at the same time as the records are pressed. So the labels are adhered when the record is pressed into vinyl. So if George Martin didn't complete the song sequencing until November 16th, and the final mono lacquer was cut on the 17th, and pressing of the records either started on the 17th or the latest November 18th, the question we have to ask is, how did all of the center labels with the sequenced songs listed, side A and side B, how did all of those labels get printed within 24 hours? It's the same thing for the album jackets. So until George Martin finishes the sequencing, the order or the list of the songs in the back of the album jacket are unknown. We don't know what sequence or what order those songs are going to be listed on the album jacket. So he has to finish that process. So the other question becomes, all right, so we have the labels. How did all the labels get printed in 24 hours and be in-house and on standby for when the pressing process began? And it's the same thing for the record jackets, because once the records are pressed, they go into the jackets, and the back of the jacket contains the list of the songs in sequence order. So it doesn't work. It absolutely doesn't work. And back in the day, it was at least a two-month process to get a record out from the time that the lacquer was finalized. So when a lacquer is finalized, what that means is, okay, now we can start creating the stampers to start pressing the record. So you have to have a completed, finalized lacquer before you can do anything. And so it's a two-month process from that point in time going out. So if the Beatles started pressing, or the vinyl lacquer was completed on November 17th, that says to us that the record, Rubber Soul, should not have been in retail until after January 17th. Yet, it was in retail on December 3rd of 1965, only 2.5 weeks after the lacquer was finalized. How did that happen? Well, the way it happened was this way. I'll just go to the quick on this. All of the songs that were credited to John Lennon and Paul McCartney and George Harrison were pre-written by outside songwriters, ghostwriters, months before. George Martin then had the songs recorded in the studio by session players, and if Phil Spector was there, maybe perhaps it was even members of the Wrecking Crew. And that's how the songs, the instrumentals came into play. So songs were written, then they were recorded, and now the instrumental tracks are done. And because the instrumental tracks are done and the songs are written, what does George Martin know? Months ahead, weeks to months ahead of time, before the Beatles show up on October 11th. He knows the names of the songs. He has the run times of the songs because he knows how long the songs are, 2.5 minutes, 3 minutes. So now, because he has the titles of the songs, because the songs were pre-written, and because the songs are recorded and edited, that's the other thing. Back in the day, there was editing that took place. And that could be, that was a process that could take some time because you're editing tape. It's not like today where you copy and paste or cut and paste. Back then, you actually had to cut the tape and, stitch it all together. So he's got the names of the songs. He's got the run times. And because of that, now he can do the sequencing. Now, then he does the sequencing. And I'm not talking about November 16th. George Martin did the sequencing weeks to months before the Beatles ever showed up. And because he has the sequencing now, he can put the requisition in to have the printing process begin. So now the labels can be printed, and the record jackets, the album covers, can be printed. And with enough time, cycle time, to ensure that they are in-house at the plant on November 17th or November 18th, whenever the pressing of Rubber Soul actually took place, to make sure they were there. Because again, the central labels are pressed or adhere to the record at the same time the record is pressed. There is no adhering the labels afterward. So that means that by the time the Beatles got into the studio on October 11th of 1965, with recording beginning on October 12th of 65, that process was a printing process. The creation of the labels on the album jackets was well underway. So that calls into question. If the songs are pre-written, that means they didn't write them. And if the songs were recorded by studio musicians, that means they didn't play on the recordings.
They just sang.
What did they sang. That's what they did. They sang. They did the vocals. It's the same thing that the Monkees did. So they sang the vocals. So what the Beatles did for 30 days was to learn the vocals and the harmonies and get that piece of the recording done. So once they finalized the vocals, George Martin could then marry the vocal tracks with the pre-existing instrumental tracks, mix it down, shazam. Now the songs are done. So Rubber Soul is a big problem for the official narrative. A big problem.
It's a smoking gun.
It's a smoking gun, and Germ, to be frank about it, nobody who means anything has ever challenged me on it. So, in other words, there are going to be the fan base that want to argue who don't know anything about songwriting or recording or the manufacturing of labels and album covers and all that stuff. They'll want to stick to the official narrative and the fairy tale, and they'll want to debate me at that level, at an emotional level. But for people who are actually in the industry, they know.
But
they know. So
what was the ultimate game plan then? I mean, you mentioned Tavistock earlier.
Yeah. The game plan was to create a band, a very, very influential and famous band, and to use that music built around a myth, a fairy tale, that the Beatles were these genius, once-in-a-lifetime, magical, prolific songwriters.
But why?
And because they used the music as a social engineering tool. So they built the Beatles up to such levels of fame and notoriety that they had a monumental following. And it's no secret that Tavistock and the Frankfurt School would explain that music, as well as the television, because the television is also, as you know, huge in influencing people's thoughts and their thinking and their belief systems and their values. So that's what they did with the Beatles music. The Beatles music was intended to disrupt the traditional values and also to undermine Christian values. And I'm not a Christian, by the way. I'm just so people know that. I'm just giving you, you know, what it is that the plan was. So it was to change the landscape. It was to change the complexity of the existing traditional values and religious beliefs of the population across the world, especially, like I mentioned, the United States was a big, big obstacle that they had to do away with. So that's what the Beatles were used for. They were a massive social engineering initiative.
Is that why the Beatles would be associated with the promotion of drug use, trips to India. What else? I'm trying to think now. Anti-war sentiment, I suppose.
Yeah, anti-establishment, counterculture, the psychedelic era. The Beatles really kicked off the psychedelic era with Sgt. Pepper. A lot of people don't know that the guy who's playing Paul McCartney, Billy Shears, was working with John Phillips and others behind the scene with the CIA. To put together the Monterey Pop Festival, where they were handing out LSD and where the CIA told local law enforcement to stand down and not to arrest anybody for the drug use that was taking place. So it's very elaborate. And back in the day, during the 1960s, this whole thing was known as the Aquarian Conspiracy. So what that means is they were setting the table for the Age of Aquarius, or otherwise known as Aleister Crowley's Aeon of Horus. So this was all table setting. The Beatles were instrumental in setting that table. And the Beatles became foundational to all of the genres of music that followed, that came after them. And that's why today we still see so much going on with the Beatles, the remixing and remastering of albums. And they just received a Grammy for that song that wasn't even a Beatles song. It was a John Lennon song that sat on the shelf for a long time. I mean, John didn't think enough of the song to actually release it now and then.
But was it a John Lennon song? Sorry.
Well, I mean, we're told that John Lennon wrote the song now and then. Yeah. In fact, there is a version of it that John sang, it sat on a shelf. He never did anything with it. And then they decided, when I say they, whoever they are, decided whether it was Billy himself, it could be, but also a kluge of others that are in the control system to, brush the song off and then do an official release of it and then call it a Beatles song. But they received a Grammy for it. I'll give you my opinion. It's not even a great song. So, they're handing out, why are they handing out Grammys? Why do they hand out awards? It's to pique the interest of the population. It's to make something seem important. It's to make something seem like you really want it. It's creating demand is what they do. It's like Peter Jackson's documentaries on the Beatles. Same thing.
All right. I want to go back to my bookmark. Tell me a little bit about Paul and Billy.
Okay. So the prevailing conspiracy theory says that Paul McCartney died in a car crash in late 1966. And he was replaced by somebody who is a, quote, lookalike. And we can get into that because Billy is not a lookalike. He wasn't a lookalike. He was transformed to resemble Paul McCartney. But he wasn't a spitting image or a doppelganger of Paul McCartney. So the rumor of Paul dying, it's called Paul is Dead, got traction in 1969. And in the book, The Memoirs of Billy Shears, which is a book that is authored or encoded by Thomas Hugh Harriot. And I believe that Billy is definitely has sponsored the book. He's behind the book. I won't get into great detail, but there's so much information in the book about the Beatles that only somebody who was within their inner circle or the person who was playing the part of Paul McCartney would know that level of information. I'll just leave it at that. So Paul was replaced. He was replaced in late 1966. Now, was it a car crash? I don't know. That's the prevailing theory. That's what a lot of people will throw out there. Was it a ritual sacrifice, which is something that the Memoirs of Billy Shears alludes to, just like Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones is suspected to have been a ritual sacrifice. He drowned in a pool, but how and why did he drown in a pool? So we have the whole 27 Club and to point to, and many researchers and people who look into this, into the music industry and the occult, would say that these deaths, whether it be the 27 Club or some other age, are Faustian bargains. Another example would be Eric Clapton losing his son Connor, his young son, when his son died, right? There are people that would make an argument that perhaps that was a Faustian bargain, because the Faustian bargain doesn't just always affect the person who signed on the dotted line. It could mean that somebody close to you is taken.
Was Eric's son 27?
No, he was a boy, young boy. He was a kid. If I remember the story correctly, he fell out a window.
Yeah,
fell to his death. And so what happened was Paul is no longer with us. Some people will say, well, maybe Paul just stepped out and he didn't die and he lived beyond 1966 and Billy stepped in. And that's all conjecture. What I want to stick to, what I've always stuck to, is that Paul was replaced. And the evidence that Paul was replaced is overwhelming. If you're objective and you think critically and you take a look at images of Paul going back to 62, 63, 65, up through early 66, and then you take a look at the person that emerges with the Sgt. Pepper album, they were not the same person. In fact, I had a comment the other day, I think it was yesterday, and some person commented and said, well, I don't believe this whole Paul's replacement, Paul is dead, Paul's always been Paul. I said, really? Go take a look at Paul McCartney in 1964, and then fast forward into the 1970s and take a look at the guy that's playing the role of Paul McCartney in the band Wings. And tell me that that's the same person. They are not the same person. Billy has a longer face. He has different ears. Until he had more surgery done, he had a very different nose. Also, he has a higher forehead, and he's taller than Paul. And we can get into this maybe a little bit. I don't know how much time we have. But a fellow researcher of mine, a colleague, Sally Witte, discovered that Billy is blind in his right eye. He has an artificial eye. He can see with his left eye. He's blind in his right eye. And Sally has presented the evidence, which I think is extremely compelling, that that is indeed the case. And in fact, Billy gave Sally a nod in an interview that he did on, I think it was on one of the networks here in the United States, maybe it was ABC, that she's absolutely right. He did the same thing with me, by the way. When I came out and said that the Beatles did not write all their own music and that they did not play on all their recorded tracks, in a CBS interview, Billy came out, this is going back about a year ago or so, he was talking about the Let It Be sessions, the Get Back sessions, and he said that to try to record 14 songs in a month, he's talking about Let It Be now, not Rubber Soul. He said that they bit off more than they could chew. And strictly speaking, it was quite impossible. Now, the reason why that's important is because by the time they get to Let It Be, they have all these other albums under their belt. All of these other studio albums. So we're to believe that in 1965, in October of 1965, they were able to do this. They were able to do 16 songs, 14 songs, like I said, just pick a number, writing from scratch in 30 days. But when they get to the Get Back sessions, more seasoned, it's 3 years later, and they couldn't do it. And they didn't do it. So going back to what Sally said about Billy's eye being blind in his right eye. So there was this exhibit called Eyes of the Storm. And Eyes of the Storm was an exhibit where they had photographs that were allegedly taken by Paul McCartney, biological Paul McCartney, in 1964. And they were newly discovered, the same old nonsense. Everything's always newly discovered, or they just found this stuff. And it's the same old, same old. But be that as it may. So this exhibit has all of these photographs. So Billy's being interviewed by this person, and so they get in front of this one photograph that's blown up, and the interviewer says to Billy, "You really have to have an eye to take that picture." And Billy looks at the image, and he steps forward, and he says, "Correct, my left eye." So what Billy was saying, it's a form of what is referred to as massively speaking. For those who are not aware, massively speaking is a Masonic technique where they can reveal the truth in an encoded way. And that's what Billy was doing. He was saying in that, with the Eyes of the Storm, he was validating Sally's discovery. And then when he was talking about Let It Be, the Get Back sessions, he was going back to my work and he was saying, that guy is on a good point. That guy, Mike, is on a good point. We couldn't do it in 1969, but somehow we were able to do it in 1965. I don't know about that. So anyway, so Billy replaced Paul, and Billy explains in the book, Germ, that he has the primary contract, that there were others who paged in and out over time to play the role of Paul McCartney. That's why when you look at a lot of these images on the internet, you're going to see a whole lot of different looks. And the key to this is, and this is what I did early on, was to build a collage, starting from the early days with biological Paul and moving through time. And when you do that, when you lay the images or the photographs up side by side and you compare them, you can see that they're not the same person. What Tavistock did, though, of course, they never made that comparison because they knew most people wouldn't do that. Most people would just accept the fact that he's Paul McCartney because you're told that he's Paul McCartney. They built a composite McCartney. So over time, it just became a big blur. So you expected to see different looks of Paul. He looked this way in the early to mid-60s, and then in 67, he had this psychedelic look. And then when he got to Wings, he looked this way. And then after that, he looked a certain way. And so people were just chalking it up to an evolving appearance that was, you know, he was morphing over time, which is not what happened. they're just two different guys with doubles and lookalikes thrown into the mix. I was told by a source that from day one, for every Beatle, there were three lookalikes or doubles that were in play. From day one. So that means right out of the chute, you were looking at four different Paul McCartneys, four different John Lennons, George Harrisons, Ringo Starrs. God knows how many more after that.
And it's not improbable because, I mean, presidents of countries have got doubles.
Of course, yeah. Stalin, we could look at Stalin. Mm. He had a number. Hitler had a number of doubles. It's doubles are, it's very, very common. When you're talking about high-profile people or you're looking at operations, psychological operations, which are very high-profile, because you have to make sure you have all your bases covered, all your I's dotted and all your T's crossed. You have to make sure of that. So what Billy did was he underwent a series of surgeries, plastic surgery. He had fillers injected into his face in order to make his face more rounder, like Paul McCartney's, because Billy's face naturally is longer and narrower. He tells us in the book that he utilized latex. Latex was used. And some folks don't understand that latex has evolved tremendously over time, that the first time latex really hit the mainstream was with The Wizard of Oz in the 1930s. So by the time you get to the 1960s, you've got 30 years of latex development underway. And he admits to using latex as part of the whole transformation into the McCartney character.
If you look at him now, I mean, he looks ridiculous. You know, he's got this crazy face. I often joke and say he looks like a retired lesbian school teacher.
Well, what he looks like now is what he used to look like. So what's happened over the years is the plastic surgeries and the fillers and all that stuff, they start to fade. And so in the book, he tells us he played a character by the name of Vivian Stanshall in a band called the Bonzo Dog Band back in the 1960s with Neil Innes. Now, some people may know Neil Innes as the creator of the Beatles parody band, the Ruddles. So Billy and Neil go back a long time, and the Stanshall character is a character that Billy created. Mm. And I have done comparisons between Vivian Stanshall, who played in the Bonzo Dog Band with Neil Innes, and Billy. And guess what? Well, I have found that I believe they are the very same person, because the facial features and the resemblance is too close for coincidence. But most importantly is, Billy, as Paul McCartney, has this lazy wandering left eye, and that's because he has an artificial right eye. So the reason why his left eye seems to drift or wander a little bit is because his right eye doesn't always track with his left eye. What I have found is when Billy looks hard left, his blind right eye, the ocular prosthetic, does not follow completely. It's not completely in sync. And that same eye anomaly exists when you look at him playing the part of Paul McCartney and when he was in his Vivian Stanshall role. So we have to ask the question, if they are two different people, if they are not the same person, if Vivian Stanshall is not Paul McCartney and Paul McCartney is not Vivian Stanshall, how is it that they have the same eye anomaly? So, and I have found, like I said, I found images where the likeness is, in my opinion, spot on. Also, if you take a look at early images of the Vivian Stanshall character and you compare that to Billy's son, James McCartney, they look like father and son. Now, this is something that Billy explains in the book, in memoirs. He says, look at my son, James, and then look at me. Back in the days when I was, you know, before the McCartney transformation, when I was the Stanshall character, and you will see the resemblance, a very strong resemblance, and he's absolutely right. In fact, when people come to me and say, I don't believe that Stanshall bit, I don't believe that he played the Stanshall character, I said, okay, well, here's James McCartney, here's Billy as Stanshall, I'll leave you with that, stare at that chart for a while and then come back and tell me that those two people don't look like they're related, because they are.
What is the moral of the story?
The moral of the story is that you have a control system that is creating psychological operations, initiatives, projects to transform the world, to social engineer the world. And what's the goal? The goal goes back to what I mentioned earlier. A big player in all of this from a philosophical and ideological perspective is Aleister Crowley. I have deducted that many, if not most, of those who were in the pyramid of power subscribe to Crowley's religion of Thelema. Do as thou wilt. Follow and pursue your true will. And Crowley's teachings taught that the age of Pisces was, in his terms, the eon of Osiris, and it was an age of oppression, of humans being shackled, they weren't empowered, and they were not pursuing their true and pure will. Crowley taught that with the coming of the eon of Horus, which is the age of Aquarius, that was going to change, that man or humanity was going to be liberated. They were going to be enlightened and illuminated, and they were going to be able to pursue their true and pure will. Sounds great on paper, it really does. The problem is that Aleister Crowley was within the elite establishment. So when he was talking about this and he was going on about his teachings and his theories of Thelema and the Book of the Law, that he wasn't talking to the average Joe or Jane in the street. He wasn't talking to us. He was talking to his elite brethren. And he was projecting their vision, their world, their end state, not ours. In fact, in his book 77, you can take a look at it. It's on the internet. In book 77, it's a one-pager. He goes through a whole litany of what you should be doing with your will, what you should be pursuing. And at the very end of book 77, he says that for those who are not on board, they will be slaves and they shall serve. So the question becomes, okay, so if everybody's supposed to be enlightened and illuminated based upon the Aeon of Horus, then who are the slaves? Well, the slaves are you and me. Because like I said, Crowley, who actually worked for British intelligence, he was an agent with the British military and British intelligence going back to World War I. And some researchers would argue that that made its way even into World War II. He died in 1947. So what they're doing is they're looking to continue to push and pursue their new age, their new eon. That's what they're looking to do. And in that new eon, they're looking to have it comprised of literalists, people who believe what they believe. Unquestionably, if you're going to be an outlier, then you're going to be a slave that serves. That's what they're going for. And how are they doing this? I've mentioned and explained to my audience so many times that the control system is controlled by occultists. Occultists control the world, not your politicians, not your presidents, not your prime ministers. Everything is occulted. And they do this through their alchemy. They do it through their numbers. They do it through astrology. There's all of these various, what Crowley would refer to as ritual and magic. But when Crowley talked about magic, it was magic with a K. That's how he differentiated from stage magic. And Crowley would explain that the way you manifest through magic is to pursue your will. And that's what Luciferians do. Luciferians, Billy's a Luciferian. What we're dealing with really are Luciferians. Some of them are actual Satanists, but because Luciferians will distinguish between their philosophy and how they go about things compared to Satanists, but sometimes it can be a very blurry line. But what Luciferians do is they develop their true will, their pure will, and that's inward. So they define who they are, what they want to be, where they're going, how they're going to achieve their goals, their objectives, through their true and pure will. And they manifest that into the external world. So it's taken from within them, it manifests to the external world. What 99.99% of the population actually does, they do the complete opposite. They don't have an internal will. They don't work on it. They don't do anything. What they do is they pull in the external world that was created for them, and they bring it in. So the external world that was created by the controllers, by the Luciferians and the Satanists, are adopted and assimilated into Joe Q public, into the overall masses. And this is why they have so much control over what's going on in the world, because most people are at a severe disadvantage because they don't understand. First of all, they don't understand there's a control system. That's number one. And number two is they don't understand how this control system works and how they apply the occult to be able to manifest their outcomes. So the Beatles are all part of that. So when we talk about Luciferianism, we're also talking about the cult of Pan. And the Beatles are a reflection of the cult of Pan. I mentioned earlier about the pied, multicolored outfits on the Sgt. Pepper album, and they're holding wind instruments. Of course, Pan played the flute. It's also the cult of Dionysus. And we can see that going back to the Olympics in France when they were taking a shot at the Last Supper. And then they denied it, which was undeniable what they were doing. They were taking a shot and disparaging the Last Supper. But they came out and said, no. That's where what we're depicting there is the cult of Dionysus. So they openly admit that it's Dionysus, it's Pan, it's Luciferianism. It's, like I said, and sometimes the line between Luciferianism and Satanism gets blurred, but let's just even say Satanism. The issue we have is most people have no clue what the cult of Pan or the cult of Dionysus is all about. The whole woke movement comes in under the cult of Pan and the cult of Dionysus. And it's also cultural Marxism, which goes back to the Frankfurt School. The Frankfurt School is, you know, connected at the head of Tavistock. Yeah, Tavistock, right. But the Frankfurt School and Tavistock came into creation about the same time in the early 1920s. I know, Mike, that was a boatload of stuff.
Well, listen, I think I could listen to you for hours, but time is against us. I'm sweating. I've got all the lights shining on me. So maybe I'll bring you back for part two, because this is really intriguing. For now, Mike, how can I follow your work?
The best thing for you to do, or anybody else to do who's listening, Jerm, is to go to my hub website, sageofquay, sageofquay.com. And all of my links will be there to all of my platforms, as well as links to my music.
Before I end the conversation, what do you make of I'm the Walrus?
Well, we can go to Sharon Clemens' work. I interviewed Sharon Clemens. If you have an opportunity to interview Sharon, I would suggest that. She wrote a book called Forbidden Fruit. I don't know if you know of her work. Mm-mm. But she says that I am the Walrus, and her work is very compelling. She explains that I am the Walrus is just loaded up with Paul is Dead clues. And she believes that Paul McCartney actually was taken out in August of 1966 during the latter part of their concerts. I think the concert in Seattle, if I have Sharon's story correct. And she wrote a book on it, and it has nothing to do with the memoirs of Billy Shears. She has her own standalone research on it. I would highly recommend that people take a look at it. So I would, to answer your question, I know there's other stuff out there, like I Am the Eggman, Humpty Dumpty on the Wall, couldn't put them back together, blah, 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 all that stuff. But I really think that we need to set that aside and focus on Sharon's work, because I think that she's onto something.
Mike Williams, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you so much. I know it was a lot, but if you have me back on, we'll talk some more about it.
If you enjoyed this, please visit germwarfare.com.